Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later this hour, I'll discuss the chaos, the violence, also the impending famine in Haiti, with Haitian-born Iowa scholar Dimi Doreska. Also, of course, March Madness kicking off. I'll talk with the Gazette sports columnist Mike Halas about that. Also, we discuss a new Grinnell College poll that explores gender and partisan views of college sports with political scientist Peter Hansen and with two Grinnell women's basketball players who are also poli-sci majors. But first, an update on activity at the Iowa State House. Let's talk with Stephen Gruber-Miller of the Des Moines Register. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Ben.
So let's talk about AEAs, the Iowa's area education agencies, dominating the 2024 legislative session. Kim Reynolds, we remember, announced a sweeping plan to overhaul these agencies in her condition of the state address back in January. More back and forth on this overhaul this week. House and Senate Republicans in recent weeks passing their own versions of it. What happened this week?
Yeah, that's right. So hard as it is to remember back to Monday, the week actually started off with the Senate passing their version of an AEA plan. And today, yesterday, Thursday, the House responded and passed an amended version that House lawmakers are hoping is the final word on this subject. When asked if it was take it or leave it, House Speaker Pat Grassley said, that's our expectation. So they're not interested in another back and forth, but we will see if the Senate is interested in what the House has sent them.
Okay, tell us, what is in the latest House version passed yesterday?
Yeah, so let me see if I can do it all here. So one of the primary factors of this House bill is that it keeps 90% of state money that goes towards special education with the AEAs. Schools would get flexibility over 10% of the state funding that currently goes to special education. And House Republicans said that they wanted AEAs to continue to be used for special education. That was important to them. The House plan also gives schools total flexibility over state funding for things like media services and general education services, which pay for a variety of things. They can choose whether to use the AEAs for those services like they do now, or they can choose to use a private provider or some other form. The bill also raises teacher pay from the current minimum of $33,500 a year to $50,000 per year after a one-year phase-in. And it would give experienced teachers with at least 12 years of work experience a minimum salary of $62,000. It has other money to pay experienced teacher salaries, and it has $14 million to pay salaries for non-salaried school staff, like paraeducators, so to increase their pay. And finally, the bill sets the increase in state per pupil aid to schools at 2.5%.
Do we have an idea how this is likely to be received by Senate Republicans?
That's the question of the hour. Jack Whitfer, the Senate Majority Leader, sent a statement essentially saying he appreciates the continued progress and that Senate Republicans will look at this bill next week and decide what to do with it, essentially. They may accept it. As I said earlier, the House has indicated they don't want to pass this again, but we'll have to see if it's something that once the Senate Republicans sit down and talk about it, that they can accept. Governor Kim Reynolds does seem more open to this. She praised the House last night for passing this bill, so it seems likely that she would sign it.
I understand a number of Republicans joined Democrats in opposition. What is the nature of that opposition?
Yeah, we don't have a total idea because none of them spoke on the floor, but there were 9 Republican votes against this. Several Republicans voted against the first version as well. I think there's been a lot of reluctance to this policy among certain Republicans. And I can just tell you what some of the concerns are more generally. I don't know if these are the Republicans' concerns in particular, but there have been concerns about the effect of changing this AEA funding system on rural districts that rely on the AEAs for more services than more urban districts do, making it, you know, more difficult for them to pay for things on their own that they get from the AEAs currently, or more difficult to get the kind of special ed services for their students. Beyond that, I guess I don't want to speculate too much, but they will likely be putting out, you know, statements on social media and saying things to their constituents about why they voted the way they did.
Stephen, before we move on, I wonder, in your years of covering the Iowa State House, how unusual is it for a party in firm control of both chambers to struggle this much with legislation to meet a governor's major priority?
It's interesting because this is sort of what we've seen in the past few years with education savings accounts, the private school bill that the governor was trying to push through. That actually took her 3 years. It took her until the third try before she was able to get a version of that bill past the legislature. And of course, there was an election in between, and she primaried certain Republicans who disagreed with her, and several seats flipped, and Republicans were able to expand their majority and finally pass the private school bill that the governor was pushing for. So there is precedent for certain factions of the Republican Party not to be in agreement with the governor on this, and she has shown that she is okay to sort of push for what she's proposing and trying to get that through. So,
mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Stephen Gruber Miller, State House reporter with the Des Moines Register, focusing on a few of the developments at the Iowa State House this week. The Iowa House sending Texas-style immigration enforcement as a proposal to the governor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this bill is really modeled after the Texas legislation that would allow state and local law enforcement to arrest an undocumented immigrant who was previously denied entry to the country or was deported. The Justice Department under the Biden administration is currently suing Texas over their version of this legislation because they say it steps on the federal government's authority to enforce immigration law. It could create chaos with a patchwork of different laws across different states, really have adverse effects on international relations and alliances. So the version of the legislation that's on Kim Reynolds' desk, and she has said she will sign this, like I said, would allow state and local law enforcement to arrest people in the country and illegally, and it would step up the penalties if they've previously been arrested of other crimes. And as part of the outcome of this, it directs judges to order the deportation of these people if they're convicted of this offense of illegal reentry.
Okay, Stephen, how much does this Iowa law going into effect hinge on that Supreme Court, the court action concerning the controversial Texas law?
I think that the court's decision in that Texas case will really determine whether this Iowa law is allowed to go into effect. I don't know if an official court challenge would need to be filed here in this state, but certainly the legislation is almost identical, if not identical. And so the same principles would apply. So whatever the Supreme Court decides will have an impact on whether this Iowa law can take effect.
Stephen, let's move on to a couple of other things before we say goodbye. A proposed constitutional amendment to keep all state personal income tax at a flat rate.
Yeah, that's right. So your listeners probably know a couple of years ago, Governor Reynolds signed a law that phases Iowa to a flat rate by 2026. Her legislation in 2022 would bring Iowa down to a 3.9% rate. She's proposed speeding that up and taking that faster. So there is already a flat tax law on the books in Iowa. What Republicans would like to do now is change the Constitution so that if there is an income tax at all, it would have to be a single rate income tax. They wouldn't be able to put a progressive income tax system in place like Iowa and many other states have had for many years. And to pass a constitutional amendment, the benefit of this from the Republican perspective is it's a lot harder to change once that goes into effect. So the legislature would have to pass it this year, and then an election would have to happen. They would have to pass it again, and then it would go to a statewide vote where a majority of Iowans would have to support it in order to add it to the Constitution.
Right. And of course, arguments against this is that a flat tax is regressive. Whether you make a lot of money or a little money, you pay the same percentage of tax. And some say that's just not fair, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Democrats say that the wealthier should pay more in taxes. It's based, you know, based on your ability to pay rather than everyone paying the same rate regardless of income.
The House has passed another eminent domain bill. Boy, this issue has been around for a long time, left over from the last session, isn't it? What's going on here?
Yeah, that's right. So for several years now, House Republicans and Democrats, this has been a bipartisan issue in many ways, have been trying to pass legislation that helps landowners who are concerned about carbon capture pipelines that are being proposed across the state. So this particular bill would change the process by which you can go to court to decide, challenge the use of eminent domain. So this would let both parties, the landowners who are having eminent domain used against them and the companies or entities that are seeking to use eminent domain, it would allow them to go to court sort of at the beginning of the process rather than the end of the process to get a quicker declaration from the court on whether eminent domain is proper in the case. So the supporters of this bill in the House say, listen, this is really good for everyone because you don't have to wait years possibly for, you know, decisions or on all other aspects of a project to go through. You can find out at the beginning of the process whether eminent domain is appropriate, is lawful in your particular case, and then you can go about your business.
Do you believe this may eliminate the sticking points that have existed up to this point?
It's a different approach than the House has taken in the past. Previous House legislation has been more focused on limiting the use of eminent domain by some of these companies that are seeking to build pipelines. This bill really just, like I said, changes the way the process works, and it's intended to speed it up. That might be more palatable to Senate Republicans, but they have yet to really take up any eminent domain legislation, so we'll have to see if this is any different.
Okay. Anything else as we part today that you'll be watching?
Yeah, the AEA bill is the main thing because, remember, it just includes also teacher pay and school funding levels. So lawmakers really want to get that sorted out before they start work in earnest on the state budget. State budget and potentially whether the state can afford any further tax cuts like we discussed earlier, those would be also on the agenda, but they can't really do that until they have clarity on how much money goes to schools, because that's really the biggest piece of the budget.
Stephen Gruber-Miller, State House reporter with the Des Moines Register. Thank you for your great reporting, Stephen, and the insights in this conversation. Take care.
Thanks, Ben.
We'll be back after a short break. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The chaos, violence, impending famine in the country of Haiti in the Caribbean has been largely overshadowed by other crises in our news. The country has been convulsed by a surge of gang violence. It's turned parts of the capital, Port-au-Prince, into a war zone and has shut down the main airport. Let's get a view of this crisis from a Haitian-born professor who has been a faculty member at the University of Iowa for over 10 years. Welcome to Dimi Doreska. Welcome to our studio, Dimi.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
You are Clinical Associate Professor, Executive Director as well of the Institute for International Business at the UI Tippey College of Business. Let's focus on the conditions in your homeland. Tell us more about what's going on.
Well, Ben, this is a situation that has been boiling since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in 2021. And before that, there was some, you know, some tensions and unrest. But the governance issue has started since the assassination, where you have a prime minister that was selected by President Moïse before his assassination. And when he got installed after the funeral of President Moïse, his sole mandate was to organize the elections. And basically classical Haiti habit, he thought that he needed to stay for a long period of time before organizing the elections. And he never could give a date for the elections. And at the same time, the unrest continued in the country. Unrest really, activated by different gangs that exist in Port-au-Prince. And those gangs, I have to mention that, were created by the political elite and the business elite to protect their own interests. But those gangs now, they've become so powerful because they have earned income from kidnapping, ransom that began from kidnapping of individuals, Haitians, expatriates, tourists, and aid workers in the country, and also drug dealings. So they are able to buy heavy weapons illegally, trafficking from the border, the Dominican Republic's weapons that are come from the United States. No one knows how they managed to acquire those weapons from the U.S. That's the topic of another conversation. And those gangs, they've become independent. They told their masters, the political elite and the business elite, that we are not going to take any order from you. We are going to terrorize the population. We are going to divide Port-au-Prince into your Port-au-Prince and mine Port-au-Prince. Port-au-Prince is the capital of Haiti. And then we are going to have our own stronghold where you will not have access. So that's what's going on now. And then when you talk about the gang stronghold in Haiti, Ben, you're talking about places where dire poverty exists, where people are dying of hunger, where malnutrition and all sort of diseases. No one knows what's happening in those strongholds.
Tell us more, Dimi, about the horrendous conditions for everyday Haitians. What is it like to survive day to day there? What are you hearing?
Well, it's just the situation is serious, Ben. My wife talked to her godmother recently, and she was narrating her daily activities. She said she has to get up early in the morning to go to the market to fetch public market, as it is in most developing countries, public street markets to fetch, to buy food. So this, even if you have money in your hands for the those who can afford to have money, you would go to the market to find nothing because products cannot come from outside of Port-au-Prince. There is no transportation. Everybody is afraid. The petit marchand, what we call in Haiti, like the little sales women, they are mainly women, they are afraid. They don't want to bring their rice, their beans, their meat, their chicken to the markets to sell. So she has money in her hand, goes to the market to find food. She can't find anything to buy. So now can you imagine those who don't even have money? They cannot really find anything. That's the situation. That's just one example that I'm giving you. So because we are in touch with people on the ground, we know what's going on there.
So it's not an exaggeration to say Haiti is on the brink of a famine.
It is not an exaggeration. And now I'm giving you an example in Port-au-Prince. Now let's go outside of Port-au-Prince. You find what we call a lot of people that are leaving Port-au-Prince, to resettle in the countryside, in the provinces. Okay, it's kind of like internally displaced people that are forced to be internally displaced, and now they would go in the provinces, in Lekai, in Carpathians, or even most remote areas to live with relatives. When they go there, they go with nothing. No money, no food, et cetera, et cetera. So they are putting heavy burdens on those relatives that don't even have enough food to feed themselves. So that's the situation.
And I understand, Dimi, there's a great crisis in getting medical care for those who need that as well.
That is correct. And it was always a problem before this crisis, okay, with, you're talking about since the earthquake, that the main earthquake that everybody know, the 2010 earthquake, then the pandemic arrived, then the assassination of the president. Then there was that earthquake in the south of Haiti in Lekai in 2021, where many people died. So it's crisis after crisis. But I can tell you this time, this is man-made and it's making the situation worse. Nobody is talking about the internally displaced people in Haiti that are leaving Port-au-Prince in massive numbers to go to the countryside, go to the provinces, and put heavy burdens on their relatives that cannot even find food to feed themselves. So those are the situations that are not being reported in the media. I mean, when you take the international media now, some of them are based in Haiti. They are not even in Port-au-Prince. They are in Carpathians, and from what I heard, and they cannot even go in places where
it's too dangerous.
It's too dangerous for them to go. So really, they cannot report realistically what's going on inside Port-au-Prince, inside the gang strongholds where people are dying of hunger, et cetera, et cetera. So that's and you have to be a Haitian to have people on the ground that you communicate with on a regular basis to hear stories like. My wife was getting from her godmother in Haiti to hear stories that I get from my former classmates that are still on the ground in the country. So those are the kind of things that we are talking about.
Yeah. You worked for a time in Haiti's finance ministry after graduating from Georgetown University, I understand. Then you left due to the corruption you had to deal with, I understand.
Yes, that's exactly right. And many people like me had to do the same thing. But we are willing to continue participating in the development of the country. What are we looking for? We are looking for good governance. We are looking for responsible leadership. We are looking for a situation where there are initiatives to eradicate corruption. And we know that we can be part of the solution. Now, what is going on now with CARICOM and other members of the international communities like the United States, Canada, France, etc., that are trying to impose a solution upon the Haitians, I believe it is not going to work. It's not going to be sustainable. What I think needs to happen is give the Haitians the field to work out a solutions themselves. And one thing they are not doing, I'm talking about the international community, is reaching out to us living outside of Haiti, the Haitian diaspora. Let me tell you, Ben, more than 80% of the Haitian intelligentsia is living outside of the United States. Majority of them right here in the United outside of Haiti. More than 80% of the Haitian intelligentsia is living outside of Haiti. And the majority of them right here in the United States. People like me, I know many of my friends, Haitian American friends, that are high level in academia, in the private sector, that if you reach out for them and ask them to be part of a mediation council made of Haitian in the diaspora to mediate the crisis in Haiti, they will be more willing to be part of this. That way, it will show it's a solutions made in Haitians, made by Haitians and for Haitians. So what I'm advocating, and I don't think the international community ever thinks about this, is I don't think they ever thought about it. A mediation council made by Haitians living in the diaspora, people like me, to talk, to kind of like be part of the solutions, to mediate the discussions between the political elite in Haiti and the business elite and the Haitian people in general.
Yeah.
That could create, that could bring lasting solutions. And Ben, let me tell you why. The remittances that we send to Haiti represent close to 25% of the country's GDP. That's about 4.5 billion US dollars. So that's significant remittances. And that money goes directly to the Haitian people. Directly. So if the diaspora was not doing this, there wouldn't be. I mean, Haiti would have been really in deep trouble right now. Even despite the fact that what's going on now, things have been a lot worse.
Dimi Dureska, thank you very much. We hope for better days very soon in your native land. Haitian-born professor who has been in the faculty at the University of Iowa for over 10 years. Dimi Dureska, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, Ben. Such a pleasure.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Five teams from Iowa in the NCAA tournaments. March Madness, both men and women teams from ISU and Drake qualified for the tournament. And of course, the UI women's team, the number one seed. Mike Loss, sports columnist with the Gazette, joins me now. Hi, Mike.
How are you?
I'm fine. You've already covered some games that have been played. Give us an update.
Well, last night in Omaha, through the luck of the draw, both Iowa State and Drake's men were at the same site. An easy trip for fans of both schools, and they did a great job of helping fill that arena. Iowa State rolled over South Dakota State, as pretty much expected. And Drake, after leading by 7 or 8 points with 8 minutes left, lost to a Washington State team that is bigger and that will now play Iowa State next Saturday in Omaha.
What about the women? They haven't played yet.
No. This all gets going this weekend. The Iowa women are at home Saturday afternoon against Holy Cross. And I think I will be able to name the score in that one. And it gets serious right after that. Monday, they would play either Princeton or West Virginia. And if they win that at home, then things get really crazy and they go out east to Albany, New York. It's an absolutely stacked region.
Yeah.
UCLA will be there, LSU, Louisville. Whoever Iowa plays in Albany, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah. Mike, you've been covering sports for so many years for the Gazette. Does this year have an entirely different feeling with Caitlin Clark and the UI women doing so well?
Well, it goes back to last year. I've never covered anything like it. It goes beyond just the team going all the way to the national championship game. It's the phenomenon, the attention surrounding it, the power of personality and of celebrity and of a team that really has wrapped its arms around more than just Iowa fans, but a whole nation of basketball fans. Sellouts everywhere they went. I went to the Iowa-Indiana game in Bloomington, Indiana, and the waiting lines to get into the arena in Indiana for that started several hours before the game and stretched for city blocks. There's never been anything like it in Iowa basketball history, and I dare say there hasn't been anything like it in college basketball history. People everywhere and anywhere know who Caitlin Clark is, and whether they like it or not, and they don't seem to mind, they are the straw that stirs the drink in this postseason.
What will it take for the UI women to capture the national championship?
they'll have to be sensational. If they were to win five games and get to the final against South Carolina for a rematch of the national semi win last year, South Carolina is an absolutely dynamic team. Has not lost a game all season. I assume South Carolina would make it to the final, but I guess I shouldn't. But before that, the teams I listed that stand in the way, including defending national champion LSU, and a UCLA team that's kind of gone unnoticed in this bracket that Iowa's in, but is really, really good. The Hawkeyes can be nothing short of great to get back to the Final Four.
Yep. Mike Loss, sports columnist with the Gazette. Thank you for joining us. You're on the road. Drive safely and enjoy the rest of the tournament. Let's hope for the best here in Iowa for all of our teams.
I'd appreciate it, and thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we'll discuss a new Grinnell College national poll that explores gender and partisan views of college sports. It's River to River from IPR News.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as March Madness kicks off, let's discuss a new Grinnell College national poll that explores gender and partisan views of college sports. Joining us, he was with us earlier this week on Politics Wednesday, Peter Hansen, Associate Professor of Political Science, also Director of the Grinnell College national poll. Welcome back, Peter.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be back.
Great to have you, as well as two of your students. Sarah Boer is a third-year Grinnell College student, also a basketball team captain at Grinnell, and plays center. Sarah, welcome to you.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Skylar Thomas, a teammate there, second year at Grinnell. You play forward on the basketball team there. The Pioneers. Skylar, welcome to you.
Thanks, Ben. Excited to be here.
Let me go to you first, Peter. You joined us earlier this week to share parts of this latest Grinnell College national poll, that having to do with children and social media, the Biden-Trump rematch. But you also surveyed Americans about gender and partisan views of college sports. What did you ask about?
Well, I mean, first, Ben, I have to say that we were really excited to ask these questions, and that's in part because we're, like everybody else in Iowa, we've just been swept up with the excitement of Caitlin Clark's incredible performance with the Iowa women's basketball team and the run they're making right now in March Madness. And you know, with the nation's attention focused on college sports and on women's sports in particular, we thought this was a terrific time to ask them a couple of key questions about college athletics. So the first question we asked has to do with the attention that people pay to sports and whether they give equal attention to men and women's sports. And, you know, beneath this, I think, is a really serious question, because we have to remember that the incredible success we're seeing today right now, for example, with the Iowa women's basketball team, is built on decades of hard work in colleges and universities trying to create equity between men and women's sports. And so when you watch your TVs right now, it seems like we're at this breakthrough moment. And we wanted to know if that's how the public feels. So we asked, compared to the attention the public gives men's college sports programs, do you think women's college sports programs receive more attention than they deserve, less attention than they deserve, or about the right amount of attention? And here's what our respondents told us. You know, before you get too excited thinking that we've achieved parity between men and women's sports, they say not so fast. 50% of our respondents said that women's sports get less attention than they deserve. And what's really interesting here, of course, as you dig into the data, there's a really big gender divide. So So 62% of women say that women's sports get less attention than they deserve, compared to about 38% of men. So clearly women have been really attentive to this problem. They're excited to see the attention that sports programs like women's college basketball are getting, but they believe there's more work to be done.
Yeah. And also there's a difference in terms of the party people belong to. What did you find out there?
Well, there is partisan difference. And so Democrats were more likely to say that women's sports received less attention than they deserved, and Republicans were more likely to say that things are about right. And, you know, in some ways that's not so surprising. I mean, sports are a part of culture, and we've got our political divide in the country is in part a difference in cultural views. So that was interesting to note as well. But clearly the overall takeaway here, the message from Americans overall was there's a lot of great programs out there that we could still do a better job covering, and they'd like to see more of that coverage.
Skylar and Sarah, as collegiate women's basketball players there at Grinnell, I know you were involved in creating this poll. Your input was needed there. But first of all, before we talk about that, what's your reaction to the poll findings that Peter just described? Sarah, please, first.
Yes, I think undoubtedly being a women's basketball player in the state of Iowa right now, the Caitlin Clark effect is very real. The attention that's being paid to those Iowa women's basketball players is amazing to see. My initial reaction is that it's great to hear that people are still seeing the gaps that in attention to women's sports, because I think that is a very real reality for especially lower divisions of women's sports and women's sports beyond basketball. I think at the Division III level, there's still a gap in terms of attendance between men's and women's games. We play doubleheaders with our men's team, so we see the attendance at the end of the men's game going into our game. And I'd say on average, we get about a third of the attendance that the men's team does. So I think while the Caitlin Clark effect is really prominent around us, that hasn't necessarily affected our attendance, the attention paid to women's sports at Grinnell, and I think among a lot of other sports at the Division I level as well.
Mm-hmm. Skylar Thomas, talk about these findings. Any surprises here for you in what the respondents said?
Sure. I think maybe less surprises. I know we noted this 24-point gender gap between women who say that college sports programs, women's sports programs get less attention than they deserve, and men who answered to that prompt. I know that Peter and Sarah and I had discussed before we put this question into the poll how we were expecting probably to see a significant gender gap there, and we're looking forward to being able to break that down. So I think that kind of confirmed a hypothesis that I might have had before we put out this poll question.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your involvement, Skylar and Sarah, in this. Peter, give us a broad overview of how you use students, particularly Sarah and Skylar, in this poll, creating it.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the reasons we conduct the Grinnell College National Poll is because it's a great way for students to learn. You know, so they help us write the questions, they help us analyze the data. And as they do this, you know, they learn about politics, and they learn of how people think about values, they learn skills in data analysis. And so it's a real value added to the education that they receive. And honestly, we couldn't do this project without them. They do an enormous amount of work. And so as we were thinking about this poll, we knew we'd be releasing it during March Madness. And as I said, I've been so excited to be following women's basketball in Iowa, and we just felt like this would be a great time to be asking about college athletics. So I reached out to Skylar and Sarah, and they were sort of obvious choices. They're both terrific political science students. Skylar is in my polling class right now. I'd had Sarah in a constitutional law class. She's also, by the way, a Truman Scholar finalist. She'll be interviewing for that on Monday, so we wish her luck with that. So we've got these stellar students. You know, they're sharp, they're thoughtful, and Sarah and Skylar are both terrific athletes, and they know a lot about sports overall. So I turned to them to help me develop these questions, to think through the implications and the wording, and they were both an enormous help, and these questions really benefited from their insight.
Skylar, talk about your involvement here. What are your takeaways from the involvement, the input you were able to give this poll?
Sure. So Yeah, Peter reached out to me specifically about working on this question on gender equity. So I met with him to kind of talk through the draft of the question that he had already and how we might improve that, and whether we were really asking the right thing, if we were getting it, you know, the meat of what we really wanted to know. And so originally we'd been asking kind of just, the question was asking people just how much attention do you think women's college sports programs were getting? And I was kind of interested in narrowing that down and asking really about deservingness. And do we think that women's college sports programs are receiving the attention that they deserve? So that's an edit we made and, you know, went through a number of drafts of questions to reach this final one. And that was a really great experience. You know, in Professor Hansen's polling class, we did a number of readings and some other work with drafting questions. But I think it was great to be able to apply this to something that's, you know, really relevant in my life and important to me as a student athlete in college. So I'm really grateful for that experience.
And Sarah, what is your main takeaway here from your work in this poll?
So I haven't actually been able to take Professor Hansen's polling class, but being able to be a part of writing these questions made me consider the ways in which you word the questions and how those might impact how respondents are interacting with the questions. I know with the question we asked on gender equity in sports, it really came down to an aspect of deservingness. We're asking about if women's college sports programs are receiving attention that they deserve. So I think just adding that part of the question and considering the impacts of that was really interesting. And we had a lot of similar conversations about the question we asked about professionalization of sports as well.
Let's circle back to the Caitlin Clark effect. That's become a term. Of course, she's at the center of basketball, the University of Iowa senior, born and raised in Iowa. Now the most famous face in basketball, men or women's basketball, by far, and her impact on viewership has been seismic. People flocking to watch her on TV, in person. I wonder if you think, Sarah, to you first on this, is there, you both noted earlier that, you know, the turnout for lower divisions of basketball and women's basketball hasn't received the Caitlin Clark effect perhaps yet, but are you hoping this is a turning point?
I am really optimistic about that. I think the fact that we're seeing athletes, men's and women's athletes alike, talk about Caitlin Clark and get excited about what Iowa women's basketball is doing this year is really promising in terms of the attention being paid to the sport and just more respect given to what women's athletes have always been doing, always been working hard to do. And I'm really glad that Caitlin Clark has come out. She's absolutely this explosive superstar. And I'm really hopeful that as men's and women's athletes get excited about her gameplay, and especially as younger athletes, I have several younger cousins who play basketball and just get so excited about Caitlin Clark and want to be the next Caitlin Clark. I think that's really a great sign for the next generation of women's athletics.
Peter Hansen, we have just a moment left in this conversation, but I imagine you'll be polling in the future to see if these attitudes will change.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we try to repeat questions over time so we can follow the public's attitudes as they shift. And I think this is one we'll definitely want to ask in the future.
Peter Hansen, director of the Grinnell College National Poll, Sarah Boer and Skylar Thomas. They are women's basketball players at Grinnell and also poli-sci majors at Grinnell College. Sarah, Skylar, Peter, thank you all.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
And that just about does it for this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from IPR News on this March 22nd. Did you know
On this date, March 22nd in 1963, the Beatles' first album, Please Please Me, was released. Now for someone who makes me twist and shout for joy, IPR Studio One host Tony Daner, here to groove us into the weekend. Hi, Tony.
Oh, my gosh. Hi there, Ben. That might be my favorite intro yet. Incredible.
Let's twist and shout, groove, whatever your music makes us do. What do you have first up to bat?
Two artists today who are famous for lots of projects they've got going on. Both have new solo records out. So first, it's Mary Timoney. She's a longtime indie and alternative rocker. She's been in the bands Wild Flag, Helium, and a band I got to see live one time, X-Hex. She's a great singer, great guitar player. This new solo record from Mary Timoney is called Untame the Tiger. It is her fourth album, fourth solo record, that is. I love the guitar and the percussion on this song. About halfway through, it's about a 6-minute long song, Ben, so we don't have time for the whole thing, but there's some great string parts about halfway through this song called No Thirds from Mary Timoney. So I'll travel.
Okay, Tony, now I know which guitar riff I'll have stuck in my brain all weekend. It's a nice one, Mary Timoney.
Yeah, love it. Love it.
No thirds. We have time for one more.
Okay, this one is from Eric Slick. He is the drummer for the band Dr. Dog, kind of a favorite of ours at Studio One. They have scaled back their touring, so he maybe has time for some other projects. He's worked with some pretty big names in music, including Taylor Swift. He played drums on one of her songs. New solo record on the way. It's called New Age Rage, and he's kind of trying to capture kind of the dark sound of 80s synth pop. And he wrote this song backstage at a concert. It's about being a people pleaser and trying to get out of that habit and that mindset. This is Eric Slick, Anxious to Please. You made me happy.
Thanks so much, IPR Studio One host Tony Daner, grooving us into the weekend. Let's go out with Eric Slick, Anxious to Please. Tony, great selections as always. Tune into your daily soundtrack, IPR Studio One, with Tony, CC, and Mark. Take care, Tony.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
Today's program produced by Samantha McIntosh, our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.